For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, and gentlemen, this week we're talking about science and religion.
Oh!
Is there any compatibility between the two?
That is a great question.
I think we need help.
We need a lot of help, right, Mark?
We always need help,
too. Right. Well, we are really blessed today because we have two phenomenal guests in the cave. First, let me introduce Dr. Paul Giesting. He's got a PhD in geology from the University of Notre Dame, so a lot to talk about there. Really involved in advance. It was so interesting about what he's doing. We're going to learn about more today in the show is how he's advancing the conversation around this compatibility, or maybe lack thereof, we're going to find out, between faith and science. And then also we have William Schmidt, or Bill. Bill is a, let's call him a freelance marketer, communication specialist, journalist. He's up in what I like to call, lives up what I like to call God's country up there in South Bend. Writes for Today's Catholic. And please welcome Paul and Bill to the show.
Thanks for having us. We really appreciate the chance.
Well, it's fantastic. So let's start off with maybe I'll throw it over to you, Paul. Tell us a little bit about what your current project is as it pertains to the conversation between faith and science. What have you been up to?
So Bill and I go way back. We met at Notre Dame many years ago being the early aughts now, you know, about 15 years ago. And so we started a podcast early last year called That's So Second Millennium. Bill didn't talk me out of the name. That's a little too precious. The idea behind the name is that we should get out of the second millennium in terms of this artificial distinction between faith and religion being completely incompatible. And we should go back to, the early second millennium, because that was where Catholic thought was really integrating faith and science. That's where the great people like Albert the Great, Thomas Aquinas, and a host of others were working on putting the best Greek science together with Christian theology and doing the hard work necessary to say, okay, what does the world actually look like if these are both true?
So, Bill, how did you get involved with your background in communication and journalism? How did you get involved with Paul? I mean, what sort of struck up? I mean, it's such an interesting project that you're engaged in. What did you find attractive about joining forces to engage in this conversation?
Well, I was drawn from the world of journalism, which I practiced in New York and Washington, to go back into the world of higher ed, and I had this opportunity to join Notre Dame's communication staff back in 2003. And of course, I wanted to meet as many interesting professors as possible, especially the ones who were informed by Catholic values. And I signed up for this program called Education for Ministry that the diocese was running. And I happened to meet Paul there as a classmate in the two-year certificate program. And I said, well, this is definitely one. Paul, you were still a PhD?
Oh, yeah, I was a graduate student
at that time, right?
Yeah, I had my master's degree, and then I went to Notre Dame to get my PhD.
Right.
And my ambition was nothing higher than being a well-informed eighth-grade religion teacher.
Wow. Yeah.
I didn't know you had such highfalutin intentions for the Know Your Catholic Faith program, but
no, it was a great program, and it got me to start meeting some additional folks like Paul, and hopefully to be a little bit more informed and engaged in various acts of ministry. And so now it's turned into science and religion and discussions of same being one of my hopefully acts of evangelization.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, I guess let's just jump right into this whole science and religion question, and I'll throw this out there. You know, scientists, a lot of them would kind of say, you know, we understand that this desire to have some sort of compatibility between science and religion, but quite honestly, we're doing quite fine by ourselves. We really don't need religious intuition. We really don't need religious insight into what we're doing. It's all about what we observe, what we watch, what goes on in the natural world, and there's really not any religion that would mix into that. So, Paul, how would you respond to that? That there's really no need for any type of religious background into scientific exploration.
The problem is there are about 8 or 10 different directions I could jump from there. Let me try to keep it to. Let me try to start with what I think other people, very sensible people, would say to that. So. You know, like I'm a member of the Society of Catholic Scientists, so, you know, a number of the people in the leadership there, like Steve Barr or Bill, help me out, the guy at Cornell.
Oh, a good old Professor Lunin.
Jonathan Lunin, yeah. We only had a 2 or 3 hour interview with him the other
yes.
month. But yeah. So they would probably say you don't need religion to do science per se. You just need it for the entire rest of your life, which science can't, you know, by itself do for you.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that does take us in a great direction. And that is that I think science has this pretension that it is all-encompassing, that it will be able to discover all the secrets of the universe. There'll be nothing on left. Just given enough time and enough effort, we'll be able to know everything through scientific inquiry. And, you know, I think that's where religion does step in and say, not quite so fast.
Right. And we're unfortunately today, we're sort of undermanned in this conflict, so to speak, with people who, well, I mean, we are in conflict with people who claim too much for science. You claim that sort of thing, like what you were just saying, for science, which is impossible. And that's partly because philosophy has been on such hard times since, you know, say the 18th century. So we have so many scientists running around who have no... Like, I mean, I was listening to excerpts from an interview with Richard Dawkins the other day, and he has no clue. He has no philosophic clue whatsoever. He has no understanding of the limitations of the scientific methodology.
Yeah, I think that understanding of limits and boundaries is probably the first step of philosophy when it comes to science, because there does need to be some correction there. I mean, I really think, you know, science, to the pretensions, it starts to distort in some ways what they're coming out with, and they're making claims that are, quite frankly, claimed as scientific that are unscientific on their face.
They're really philosophic assertions that are masquerading as, I mean, they're sort of taking, it's a human tendency to take 2 or 3 points and say, and draw a straight line through them and assume things are just going to continue that direction forever. So, you know, we live in a world full of people who think that, well, we're just going to continue in a skeptical direction forever, and we're just going to disbelieve more and more things. No. We've really kind of reached the end of the line for that, as a matter of fact.
Right. And you know, I guess that takes us in another direction, and that is there's sort of a dichotomy there. You mentioned skepticism, and I think when a lot of people think about skepticism, they think about it as an antonym to faith. So right. On the one hand, you have faith. On the other hand, you have skepticism. How does that play out when it comes to scientific inquiry? I mean, to a certain extent, you do need a certain amount of skepticism mm-hmm. when it comes to science. But I think there's an argument there that you also need faith to be able to pursue science as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me try to... There's two things I'd like to try to get out in response to that. One of them is that Christianity and Judaism are actually profoundly skeptical religions. They come at the world and they say, you know what, these idols that you're worshiping, those don't work. That's really not the place to be. We, you know, the actual God is this invisible God that turns out to be, you know, this is crude language, pardon my theologically crude language, a force behind, you know, the visible universe, as opposed to some, you know, some just Superman living on Olympus, and here's his statue here. Or you think of the Acts of the Apostles, where the statue theoretically fell from heaven. So, you know, the ones where you were literally worshiping the statue. So Christianity and Judaism are themselves profoundly skeptical. I mean, Christianity is death on astrology, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that was, you know, continued to be through the Middle Ages, a war that Christianity tried to fight, you know, tooth and nail. And now it's simply we live in a world, this modern world has actually been completely shaped by Christianity. We're just trying to be, I think so much of modern liberalism is so much is trying to be more Christian than Christian.
Yeah.
And then there was the other side, and I'm going to have to, we'll see if it comes back.
Right. Yeah, you know, that skepticism also, it plays out even within religion as far as Christianity goes. I think a lot of people mistake faith for a belief in things that is completely irrational.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is faith is rigorously tried and mm-hmm. rigorously put through the ringer of skepticism. You know, even on claims that you do have to take on faith. The claims of revelation, it's not just, this was revealed, therefore you have to accept it. Mm-hmm. You accept it based on the credible testimony of eyewitnesses who were there, who saw it, and on down. So, that idea that what we believe as Christians is based on hard evidence, you know, I think that goes way back. And that makes Christianity, I think, very compatible with Western science.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it really is. At bottom, it comes from the same intellectual wellspring. I mean, everything has been routed. Everything in Western culture has been routed through at least 1,500 years of Christianity.
Right.
There's no way around that.
Well, yeah. And I think there's something within Western civilization that lends itself both to Christianity and to science. Mm-hmm. You know, science is very much a Western phenomenon. You go to Eastern culture, Eastern religion, etc. There's not the same rigorous scientific inquiry, and I think part of it is the skepticism that you mentioned there. But I think there's other aspects of Western civilization that lend itself to both Christianity and science and the development of science as well.
Yeah,
I'm curious about this trying to understand a worldview that is limited to a scientific worldview. It seems like to me science is predicated upon, at least in part, that there's an external world or external universe that is discoverable, right? Mm-hmm. And that it's intelligible.
Yeah.
So how does one, if that's the case, and then that there are certain laws that can be expressed, often mathematically, mm-hmm. that explain and predict things like planetary motion and things like that. So gravity, things like that. So in a scientific worldview, what would be the source of an objective reality that is governed by laws, if not a lawgiver?
That's the whole question. I mean, I'm going to turn to a somewhat different, to address what you're talking mm-hmm. about, I'm going to turn to a somewhat different field. Why do people actually behave the way that they do? They behave the way that they do because of enculturation. I mean, that's not all of it. But people, you look at the type of people like Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins mm-hmm. is convinced that evolution explains everything worth explaining because his worldview mm-hmm. is limited to biology.
Right.
He doesn't actually seem to care about what's beyond this picture frame that he lives within. Uh-huh. You know, why is there a universe that has physical and chemical laws that allowed life to start so that the process of evolution could do anything?
Right.
Okay. I'm a geologist. So geologists tend to be a little bit more friendly. Where, you know, even if we disagree with you, we'll sit around the campfire and have a beer.
That's right. I like that.
We all have a hunger for the ultimate. And biologists seem to have taken evolution as their ultimate. You know, a geologist might take the Earth, so there's a lot of us, more and more of us who are in planetary science now as the mm-hmm. funding dries up for terrestrial geology. but we'll take the Earth or the solar system as our huge, ultimate, and the Earth is, you know, as far as ultimates go, I mean, it's an awful lot older than us. I mean, mm-hmm. it's enormously older than us. It's, you know, it's what we depend on it. We depend on the Earth. We depend on the sun. We have we're completely dependent on those things. And that, for a lot of us, we're just not going to poke any further. That's our mm-hmm. ultimate. That scratches that itch, so to speak. We'll leave it there, quiet any other, you know, stirrings that might be in the back of our mind, and go about our business. You know, physicists have an even bigger ultimate. You know, there's a universe that has laws. But even then, most of them seem to take that for granted and don't ask that next question, what's beyond my discipline? That's a fundamentally philosophical question that we don't get taught to ask.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think also, Tim, your question goes, I think, more back to fundamental questions of philosophy, and in some ways comes out of philosophers getting out of their lane to a certain extent. That you have the...
I never get out of my lane. Every lane's my lane.
That's right. Right. That is the danger of philosophy.
As I see it.
If you saw the truck he's got parked out in front, you'd understand.
Yeah, that. That's for the... That's, I call that one the beast for the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's a big truck because if there's zombies in an apocalypse, you've got to be able to either run them over or run away, depending on how many.
Yeah. Right.
So that's what that's ready for.
But yeah, I know. I think that your vehicle there is the perfect fruit of science and technology right there.
All of it. And notice how I've incorporated a theological theme like the end of the world.
It is November after all. It's a good liturgical time for that.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I think going back to the question about objectivity and subjectivity a little bit. I think the objective universe in some ways presents itself. It's there. And science answers a great deal of questions. More questions than actually I'm qualified to ask. It answers more questions than even come to my mind about the objective universe. But what it really doesn't do is answers questions about mind and about the way the human psyche works and an understanding of sort of that spiritual center of mankind. But it tries. And I think that's where the lines get merged. On the other hand, you got philosophers that they do now try to understand mind, try to understand subjectivity, and then that starts to bleed over into questions about science, and you start to get this sort of questioning of, well, on what basis can we accept that there's objective reality out there? But that's really a philosophical question and not a scientific question. I think scientists, and correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, scientists pretty much just take that as a for granted given.
Oh, yeah, we have
and
to
move
take
from
it
there.
For granted. Yeah. I mean, we have to take it for granted there's an external world to study, that it's not simply a projection of our own minds, and that it's going to behave if we keep track. If we engage in this enterprise of keeping track of our observations and communicating with each other and sharing our ideas about what the underlying rules must be, we'll get somewhere. And it's worked out. It seems to have worked out so far.
Yeah, it worked out, but I think we're getting away from a paradigm that was set up by St. Thomas Aquinas. Well, I guess he sort of explained it. I don't know that he really set it up. But, that philosophy and theology were sciences that stood above and over and beyond the other sciences. In other words, as I said, the existence of objective reality has to be taken as a given to really be able to start on any exploration of any of the hard sciences. But that has to come from theology and philosophy. You do have to have an inquiry into it and an understanding of it. And so there's a hierarchy of the sciences, and philosophy and theology, at least in the medieval mind, stood over and above the hard sciences. And I think most scientists kind of bristle at that suggestion today, they have to take their start and cues from philosophy.
Right. Yeah. That was where this actually started. And that's, Aristotle is very big on the, divisions of sciences, and, higher sciences give the principles to lower sciences with which the lower sciences can then work. And of course that whole, and as you say, that's fighting words these days to talk about a hierarchy of anything almost.
But maybe I'm naive. Why is that such a controversial notion?
I think it really goes back to, part of it is the sheer volume now. In the 19th century, you could still be a polymath. You could still contribute cutting-edge physics and cutting-edge, say, geology. That is hard, if not impossible, to do now. There is so much more to master in order to get to the cutting edge of any discipline. So mathematics, I think the last person... I remember reading a while back that the last person to contribute to all of the different branches of mathematics, the four different branches of mathematics... was probably Poincaré at the beginning of the 20th century. And since then, it's just like you can't get to the edge. And that's true in the sciences as well. And so people simply neglect that, they don't go through the fundamental.
And you are listening to The Catholic Cave. I want to take a quick second here to reintroduce our guests. We've been talking with Dr. Paul Giesting, who's a Catholic devout Catholic, but also a scientist, a geologist, this PhD from Notre Dame. And we also have with us Bill Schmidt. He is a freelance journalist, communication specialist. And I actually want to turn the – I want to pull you in here at this moment, Bill, and ask you a question. There – and it has to do with – I don't want to lead too much with my question, but
– No, you never ask leading questions.
Right, right. So in this debate between – in conversation between religion and science, it seems like it's from a lot of the sources, media sources – that I'm exposed to and come across, it seems like it's a pretty lopsided conversation. In other words, science seems to get top billing, and religion, if mentioned, it's almost always in a either, I would say, shallow at best sort of way, and by journalists and or something that's being, you know, pilloried and vilified. So as a media specialist, as a journalist, how do you see this debate being portrayed in the media?
Well, I have certainly seen it grow as a danger in the media that, we're always looking for two or more sources, well, hopefully still looking for more than two sources of a confirmation of any fact, and so that's not necessarily the only that experimental provable truth that's going to lead us to the fuller understanding of what I know you guys like to talk a lot about, which is truth seeking. Truth is a multidimensional thing, a beautiful thing, because God created us as spiritual beings as well as physical beings. And one thing that I've become involved in is freelancing for the McGrath Institute for Church Life at Notre Dame and their program that's called the Science and Religion Initiative. And thank God, what they're doing is trying to nip this division in the bud by working with Catholic high school teachers especially of science and religion, and trying to avoid those silos that can occur in any institution of education, get the students thinking again that the process of truth seeking is a really dynamic and empowering function, and that it occurs in the religion classroom as well as in the science classroom in different ways, as you say, each staying in its own lane, but they're both on the same highway and they're both headed in the hopefully good direction, but they have to be organized and coordinated in a better way than most schools are built to pursue them. I think that that's the role of journalism as well, to help people see the full dimension. It has to be, at least in the secular press, it has to be handled, wisely with some diplomacy and openness and inclusiveness. I'm a strong believer in the saying that, seeing is believing, but believing is seeing, too. Mm-hmm. And you're not a truth seeker and as a missionary disciple unless you kind of get both.
Yeah. But, and I think you bring up a great point there that all three enterprises we're talking about, science, religion, and philosophy kind of lumped in the same group, and journalism, all three of them are truth seeking. The methodology, though, is probably where we differ, and I think the methodology of journalism is one that I think kind of might be able to sort of soften up the hard edges of the other two a little bit, in that journalism is really meant to take opinion and from opinion move towards verified fact. take two sources, etc., and get facts to be able to lead to the truth. Where science is based on observation, philosophy is based on intuition and logic and cognition. But the three really ought to be working hand in hand.
Exactly. Exactly. And we have to empower people to do that. And it starts now, unfortunately, maybe even as early as grade school, that kids are trained by our culture primarily to think that the only way to inform themselves and to be free for full inquiry into things is to go for this scientific method, which is wonderful, and thank goodness for it. But they don't realize how limiting it is for the rest of their lives to not be able to incorporate the spiritual dimension of themselves and of the world and of their relationship with God into their understanding of the problems that are going to be the most gripping and life-changing and eternal life-providing forces in their whole lives. It's almost like we're in danger of sending forth these kids kind of handicapped right from the start.
Yeah. So as a fact seeker, what do you see as some of the big controversies that seem to arise within society between science and religion? And I know that's a pretty broad question, but what do you think the biggest questions out there right now are that the general public is tending to pit scientists against philosophers and theologians?
Well, I think pro-life issues, certainly abortion at the core, and the whole range of a consistent ethic of life. Those things are very much forming more and more of a battleground, whereas ultimately I think there's this innate sense in all of us of any political stripe or the background. There's the sense that, yes, we do have some sense of our own dignity, and unless we have some kind of higher principles to appeal to, we're going to fall into the trap of defining things like dignity and community and inclusiveness and common good and so many things that are at the essence of a democracy, much less humanity. They get too easily labeled and, weaponized, I guess, is the word of the day.
No,
yes,
that's one of them. Yep. Oh. I think you really put your finger on something, too. Maybe I want to go a little bit deeper on this pro-life issue versus pro-choice, because it seems to me that is a good arena for us, especially here on Catholic Radio, to look at. I mean, there is an arena in which when you look at pro-life arguments versus pro-choice arguments, what I have found is the science, philosophy, and theology are all in favor of the pro-life side. And right. What we run up against when we try to engage in conversation with people who are pro-choice, a very rigid ideology that's bereft of science. And using terms like, I tend to watch some of these interactions, debates on YouTube, and what I keep hearing from the pro-choice side is, they use the term fetus in a very dehumanizing, otherworldly sense, as if the child in the womb is, when you hear the word fetus, you kind of go, yeah, what is a fetus? That doesn't sound like a human being. Right. A fetus sounds weird to me. Yeah, right. Destroy it, But that seems like a really important arena, this the pro-life arena, to really see the compatibility, where you can really see the compatibility of rock-solid science, great philosophy, and informed theology all lining up, all compatible to make the case for the sanctity of life.
Yeah. And it's really through the affiliation that Paul and I have been privileged to start building with the Society of Catholic Scientists that comes through so powerfully. Paul can tell you about the amazing biologist Maureen Condon, mm-hmm. right, Paul? Who,
yeah.
who is,
yeah.
You know, just a thoroughly respected scientist in all areas of academia, who she feels that it's her role as a Catholic to point out these basic facts that, you know, life, unique, complex life is there right from the very start of the very first fertilized cell.
Yeah. Yeah. Maureen Condon is trying to do amazing things where she is actually trying to do, she has a, actually, she, we interviewed her. We released the interview as three episodes on our own podcast. She was the St. Albert Award winner at this year's Society of Catholic Scientists conference that was up at Notre Dame.
Does she have a new book out?
She does. She has, I think she has two. She has a book about twinning, which is sounds fascinating, mm-hmm. and I definitely want to dip into that. Actually, the one I want to read first, though, is her book about the where she co-wrote it with her brother, who's a philosopher, and she discussed how just how difficult it is just the language that they speak being different. They had to spend an enormous amount of time just learning how to speak one another's language in order to write that book. That's what I hope we do more of in the third millennium, is actually go and look at these borderlands where there's clearly a philosophical, moral, and therefore theological consequence to the things that we learn in biology.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the abortion debate's one of them. Environmental science would be another one where there's this interplay between not just science, but also theology, also philosophy, morality, ethics,
etc. That just came up in the Amazon Synod, to say the least.
Exactly, right. And I think there's a reason.
I think there's a reason that the
church is starting to kind of try to address these issues that bring all of these disciplines together.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's clear that we, as a human race, have the ability to change the climate, the planet, you know, our environment in different ways. What are our responsibilities? That's a moral and theological question.
Exactly. There's a good and a bad to that, and we have to kind of be able to feel out and decide the good and the bad.
And we need to take a break here in the Catholic Cave. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Still in the cave, Mark Tuttle, Kent Blandford, myself, Timothy O'Donnell, and our two special guests. We have Dr. Paul Giesting. He is a geologist, PhD, Catholic, and podcaster. And so we've been talking about faith and religion and science and its compatibility. And we also have Bill Schmidt. He is a freelance journalist, communication specialist extraordinaire, writes for Today's Catholic, lives up in South Bend. And Paul and Bill are collaborators on their efforts to advance the conversation around the Catholic faith and science and other topics. And we've been engaged in that conversation ourselves today. And before the break, we were, I think what you said, Paul, you pointed out we were opening up a whole bunch of cans of worms. So I'm going to pick one worm out. Right. And the one I want to pick out is climate change, because that seems to be a topic that you have maybe several disciplines that seem to be competing and colliding between science, maybe political philosophy and ideology, theology, quite frankly, maybe some first principles of philosophy. So you had mentioned. So tell us a little bit about climate change. Maybe frame frame that a little bit for us from an informed Catholic scientist point of view. What do you think's at stake, and what do you think's going on with the debate? Maybe start there.
Yeah, I mean, to try to condense it down in terms of...
Time's up. Like, okay, yeah, exactly. Let's go to Bill.
That's right.
Bill, what
That's
do you
right.
think?
Condense it down in terms of how I taught Geology 101 when I was at the University of Tennessee. We know some things very well, and we know some things very poorly. And this is something that scientific literacy could be better than it is. That scientists have become the priests of our era, and we just kind of take what they say, and we don't, you know... think it, that science is a list of facts to be learned. This is the attitude that students seem to take, in my experience, as opposed to learning the methodology. So it's easy to measure, for example, how much carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere. That's gone up by 25% or 33%. Actually, yeah, it's like gone from 300 to 400. That's easy to measure. We know we've done something to a minor constituent of the atmosphere that could be potentially important. Temperature, that's hard to measure. You have to measure it all over the planet, and you know, so people are commonly engaged in trying to correct the historical record, and then of course, that's dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. So all of that, you know, all that plays in. We're probably doing something to the climate, and it is hard to pin down exactly what. And people get hysterical without necessarily knowing exactly what they're getting hysterical about. It's become a religion in itself. I mean, there is that. Do it. That doesn't mean that I don't think we should be doing anything about it. That doesn't mean that I don't think that we should be sort of conservative about, well, maybe we should let it go at this point and really try to move away. I mean, there's also all sorts of other good reasons. I mean, this is the problem. Political debate in general, and Bill, you can chime in on this, but it looks to me, you know, looking, this is a microcosm of, we could be finding common ground, but we're not finding common ground. I mean, like, you know, you could take the person most aggressively worried about climate change, and we should stop, you know, burning petroleum this very instant and, you know, change over to other things. And the person who is, you know, a gung-ho sort of national defense type of guy, like, let's look for the common ground. Petroleum makes really evil people a lot of money in the Middle East. Maybe we should start there as looking for common ground as opposed to immediately going to the extreme and castigating the other 49% of the population as evil people.
Right. Because I really do think there's a sort of a fourth science that's behind the scenes here in this, and that's economics. And I think ultimately when you start to peel back the climate change debate, it really is an economic debate between, you know, honestly, between laissez-faire capitalists that say, heck, whatever happens, it doesn't matter how much we pollute, it doesn't matter how much we change the atmosphere, it's all good, the invisible hand will
That's
take
right.
care of all
that
of it
that will create a market force that will correct itself, maybe.
Exactly. And then on the other hand, you have an almost Marxist element that says no, you know, capitalism is pure evil, it must be stopped, everything that's capitalist must go, the market causes all of these problems, and government must step in and interfere and get rid of the market completely. And you know,
or control it.
And I honestly think, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, that's when McIntyre steps in and says, these are incommensurable viewpoints. I mean, you guys are talking past each other.
Yeah.
All it is, it's become a shouting match and protest, and there is no commensurability even to be able to have common ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the other elements in the debate to me is to take into account is, it's if we're, as Catholics, we're of course very interested in helping the poor. And it seems that one of the necessary resources that's required to improve the standard of living of peoples is energy. You have to have access, especially electricity. So it seems like access to reliable, affordable electricity is a requirement to elevate a standard of living, because so much is contingent upon, powered by electricity. And so it's the generation of how do you create electricity in a way that is, say, friendly to, or at least responsible towards, the environment.
Yeah, and that's a big question, but it's not an insoluble one.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And then I think you touch on aspects of justice that are involved in that too, of, you know, when you're talking about growing limits towards the amount of energy that we can produce, how do we make sure that is justly distributed, that everybody has access, everybody has the ability to produce produce electricity and power to what they actually need. And, you know, how do you determine, you know, need versus desire versus extravagance, et cetera?
Well, it's really, I think that the two countries where we're seeing a play out are China and India. We have massive populations that have been historically trapped in, or stuck, I should say, stuck in very low standards of living. It seems that, and this is my critique against those who would pillory capitalism. It does seem that capitalism, though, there's good evidence to believe that capitalism over the last 100 years or less has lifted 400 to 600 million people out of poverty. Nothing else has ever done that in the history of mankind. So it seems like it's pretty effective, despite its limitations and potential shortcomings.
That's right. Yeah.
All right.
Global problems like climate change are wonderful that we're addressing them and aware of them more completely in our everyday lives. And yes, there are things that we individually can do and that we can do in the economic world, etc. But I think one of the points that Pope Francis makes. Really, it's an appeal to the wisdom of Catholic social teaching that, yes, there are these huge issues to be addressed in various ways, but the conversation about them and the action to address them has to start at the local level, and that's subsidiarity, right? And it's by understanding very basic issues of justice and mercy and care for the common good that are going to point us toward things like a healthy capitalism. We want to see a flourishing in our own communities. And what can we do to encourage that? Maybe that's a little bit more in our control than instantly or within the next 10 or 12 years, solving the global climate problem. That has to, the solutions will come if we find solutions in our individual lives and in our families and in our communities first.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole, the distributist, you mentioned the word subsidiarity. I mean, that's the whole, that's a classical, coming from within Catholic culture, critique of modern economics from, you know, both the capitalist direction and narrowing capitalist to mean big capitalism, meaning, you know, that it's run through multinational gargantuan corporations as opposed to being people. I mean, the distributist idea is that people take responsibility for some aspect of their own lives rather than being cogs in the machine.
Right.
And
but I'll defend big international conglomerates for a quick second because we often skewer them. Well, I'll tell you one thing that makes it pop. It seems, I'll go back to energy. It seems like it would be very difficult to have portable energy like gasoline at its with the reliable availability and price points that we have, unless you had a gigantic apparatus to produce it. In other words, it's not a project that 10 people can do. It's only a project that it has to be done on a gigantic scale if you're going to produce something like gasoline and make it available at the price points we have in a reliable fashion. And the other one I would point to would be something like, look at your breakfast cereal. Go to your Kroger, go down the cereal aisle, and what do you see? You see reliably, predictably, dozens and dozens and dozens of different brands of high quality, edible, nutritious cereals for $4 a box. And every store has them. Mm-hmm. That can't be done by 20 people. That has to be done on a grand scale in order to have that kind of outcome.
But I guess the question there is how integrated or disintegrated does that process need to be? is it equally likely to have that system where you have 10 individual players each playing a part within the process, and therefore each making independent decisions and playing a role of check and balance on the others? Or does it have to be an integrated system under one large, you know, corporate conglomerate, giant, global, you know, whatever
it's not one, but I'm not saying it's one that's a monopoly. What I'm saying is there are certain aspects of the economic systems where large, very large corporations serve valuable purposes.
Oh, yeah.
Such as, like, there's different companies out there, but, like, you need, for example, a Cargill. If you're going to, so, for example, adjusting for inflation, cost of food has plummeted the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Well, that's huge for who? The poor. The people who are most impacted are the people living on a dollar a day. It makes a big difference if corn is, you know, $4 a bushel or $6 a bushel. To you and I, it makes no difference. But for a large number of people on the planet, it makes a huge difference. The cost of rice, things like that. So wrongheaded ideas. Here's my chance to skewer one, which is when we went down the path of we required ethanol production.
Yeah.
When we required ethanol production as a method by which we were going to engage in some kind of renewable energy, what happened was globally, again, the United States didn't really feel it, but globally we rearranged where corn was going.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we spiked the price, not by a whole lot, by like 30 cents or so. The problem is for you and I to, when it comes to the price of corn, 30 cents makes no difference to you and I at this grocery store. But for people who are living, again, the most fragile, vulnerable communities around the globe, it immediately went from food that was affordable to unaffordable. And you throw tens of millions of people into starvation because we needed to have ethanol. That to me is an example of where science hijacked theology and care for the common good.
Yeah, and well, economics did too. I mean, I don't think you can.
It was a bad economic policy too.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't think you can.
And by the way, it ruined lawnmowers here in the U.S. because that crap burns too hot.
Right. 7G.
Yeah, but I don't think you can.
Ooh, which could have been part of a plot. Wait, tinfoil hat time. Okay, that was part of a plot by lawnmower engine manufacturers so that we'd destroy them and you'd have to buy more from them so they could money grub.
Right.
If you work for Lawn Boy, you want to send your notice to Tim
at Catholic Radio Indy.
Right.
I check that is my email, and I check it every 3 months regardless.
Yeah.
So go ahead and send it in.
But no, I don't think you can throw the scientists under the bus for
not
those
the physical
types of
scientists,
decisions.
Not the chemical engineers like, hey, if you do this, you'll get ethanol out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
You may not want to do that. That's
exactly
an economic question.
And I think that's
it's a politicization of elements. But some scientists cooperate with that kind of stuff. They're not just neutral.
Well, that's
there's plenty
true.
Of scientists that are advocates for that kind of stuff too.
The campaign for grant money is a destructive, messy, sausage making part of the process of modern science.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, and in addition to grant money, Paul, what do you think about this interplay between economics, politics, and science? And you know, ethanol would be a small example, but I mean, when you're talking about nuclear fission, I think that's a bigger example of there are huge political implications.
Yes.
For what we can now scientifically do. And, you know, the scientists are interested in the science of it. I wonder if we can take the atoms apart and harness the energy
there. I want to
there.
Study actinide chemistry because I went to school. Okay, so disclaimer, I went to Notre Dame to study uranium with Dr. Burns. Go wrap your head around that, Simpsons fans. But yes, I studied uranium under Dr. Burns. And I just want to know about, it's the lunatic fringe of the periodic table. It does weird stuff. It has F electron orbitals. And that's what I'm interested in.
Not even know what that is.
Exactly. But that's okay. Just take it from me. It's awesome. It's bizarre.
Okay.
It's awesome.
Okay.
But we have to get money from that from somewhere.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, and so that, unfortunately, you know, you see that to go back to the pro-life issue, that drives, you know, Marine Condit could tell you many stories about, you know, the unholy deals that are, you know, being struck to, you know, get
David DeLine
funding.
Exposed them all
well,
with
he
his
tried to do some of it. He could do some of it, but he couldn't encompass all of it.
You're right. You all know,
whole,
too much,
I mean,
but
the,
yeah,
the
he
whole,
did. It.
You know, fertility technology runs on these same, you know, shoving the same things under the rug.
Mm-hmm.
You know that. Well, you know, we're gonna. I mean, so you know, so we had all the brouhaha about the Chinese scientist. You know, gene editing,
cloning, and,
CRISPR gene editing, human and bringing human embryos to term, because of course that's the criminal part, not the experimenting on them. It's the actually putting them into a woman and letting them grow into human beings. That's the part that we're upset about. And there's a guy in Russia who's like, well, I'm just going to do that. I'm just going to file for, you know, I'm just going to file the paperwork. Unlike this guy who went off and went rogue. I mean, I think that's what people in the broader scientific community, unfortunately, are really unhappy. Well, he just went rogue and didn't consult the bureaucracy.
Right? Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I think there's a perception out there that to a certain extent, scientists have kind of gotten beyond ethical boundaries to a good extent. And but that's a genie that can't be put back into the bottle. Is it possible to start to curtail that, to start to bring ethics back to bear on scientific inquiry and the scientific process, so that there are ethical constraints and it isn't just simply a, well, because we can do it, we should do it?
I don't see it on the horizon, but it can be done. I mean, it will be, you know, something strange is going to happen at some point. I mean, human history is not a straight line. Human culture is not a straight line. And there will be a reaction of some sort. We don't know exactly what form it will take.
And I think ultimately, one of the answers is to add to that mix of science and economics as our sources of solutions. Ultimately, we have to start healing the rampant relativism in our society, where we tend to think of ourselves as our own gods, who can kind of impose the solutions that make sense to us onto others. They become very sweeping solutions that really, like you said, one size does not fit all. In a lot of cases, and we need to be more aware of the higher authority that comes from recognizing God and eternal and universal principles in our lives. That's going to really be the modifying force against us taking science and economics in all sorts of willy-nilly and, overly simplistic answers as the direction for solutions.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Paul Giesting and Bill Schmidt. Fellas, we're running out of time. I'd love to have you share with our audience how they can follow your work and what maybe you guys have on the horizon for your project.
Well, you can follow us at the That's So Second Millennium podcast. That's So Second Millennium, if you spell it all out and make sure you get the right number of L's and the right number of N's in Millennium. That's So Second Millennium.
Thank you. Spelling problem.
That's right. And it's on all the major podcast distribution apps: Apple, Google, Stitcher, and those.
Stitcher?
And,
never heard of that
Stitcher?
One.
Yeah,
I am quickly falling out of tempo.
They get reflected to all of the different.
Is that like
all
TikTok? What does TikTok do? I've
oh, gosh,
that
that's
one.
A little video.
Is it? Okay, see, I don't even know. That's how scrambled up I am.
I really don't. I don't want to, honestly.
That emotionally, when I made the transition from MySpace to Facebook, it was so difficult that I've refused. I'm reluctant to, and I've refused to evolve anymore into new apps and stuff
Tim,
like that. So.
Tim, Mr. Flip Phone O'Donnell.
Right, exactly. Yes. Those things are indestructible.
This is the,
that's why they stopped making them.
Yeah, this is called the Catholic Cave for a reason.
That's right.
There's a certain throwback.
The Catholic troglodyte.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
But I interrupt. So what's on your horizon, though? What are you guys working on?
On Friday, as we're recording this, so it will be before this gets released, but we're having a gold mass here in Indianapolis to celebrate Catholic science, and we hope to continue working with the Society of Catholic Scientists.
That's fantastic. How would people learn more about Catholic Scientists, that organization?
CatholicScientists.org.
CatholicScienceist.org, I believe. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, learn more about that, especially if you are a Catholic who practices science. We would love to get to know you, and please join the society and start participating. And we're hoping to, I mean, the society as a whole is hoping to create more local branches.
Yeah. And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. We'd like to thank Bill Schmidt for joining us and Dr. Paul Geisting. For Tim O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.